So we have an opportunity for questions, and Alex is the man with the microphone, it looks like. So if you could speak into the microphone because we're recording all this. Do you want me to pick them, or do you guys want to pick the questions? Why don't we start with...
You're getting paid. You
Burke, you want to start?
Richard Rahm asked me if I could remember the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1914. And I want to tell you, I was born in January 1913, and I was always regarded as a very precocious kid. Aside from that, may I ask a question? What he said about the transactions on the internet made me feel very despairing about the income tax, the future of the income tax. I just think we may have to bury it. But then I think, well, of course, then we resort to a sales tax as a substitute. And then I begin to think about that, and my question to him has to do with the issue of the sales tax on the internet, especially on merchandise transactions. How do you see that?
Well, a number of us in Washington have been sort of speculating on this. I'm on the board of the Institute for the Research in the Economics of Taxation, and sort of serious ex-Treasury types who have more of a libertarian orientation, but who are libertarians but not anarchists, and trying to figure out how we have a tax system in the future. Property taxation is easy to see. You know, David, building sitting here will still be sitting here in the digital age, and we can tax that. Merchandise, if it's, you know, large physical objects, you're probably still going to be able to do. But you look at the problem the states have already had with catalog sales. And if a company has a location, I guess let's say someplace like Oregon, where they don't have a sales tax, but I believe I'm correct in that, and they ship merchandise to states that do have a sales tax, because of the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution, they're not obligated to collect the tax. And so you have a lot of these catalog retailers located in places like this, which gets into the point of the digital hole that both Peter and I talked about. It's going to be very, very difficult. I think that, I mean, even an income tax, for all of us whose product is basically that can be sent over the internet, for those of us who write or you compose music. I mean, think about it. 10 years ago, who would have thought that the local music store would be in danger of going out of business because you could deliver music over the internet for a fraction of the cost? And this, in the internet music store, can be located any place in the world. Now, how are you going to tax that? And that's why I say the good news, it forces the downsizing of government, because the tax base will be eroded. The question that both the two of us have raised, are we going to do this in a sensible and legal way, or are we going to do it like prohibition and make everybody tax violators because it'll be easy to escape? And I'm arguing that we need to have some enlightenment with the Congress and state legislatures and others, and realize the new technologies have diminished their ability to tax and not make all their citizens criminals.
How about the gentleman?
I have a background theory for Dr. Rand and then a topic question for you both. Dr. Rand, according to your book report, you testified before Congress on taxing economic issues more than 75 times. How many times did Congress take your advice?
At times we won. In 1978, it was our first big victory. At that point, I was at the American House of Capital Formation, and we reduced the capital gains tax from 49% to 28%. A quick aside there. I was up arguing against some of the leading Keynesians of that time. In 1978, when we talked about doing the big cut, I argued that it would likely increase tax revenues by $1 billion. The folks on the other side, good Keynesian economists, argued that it would likely reduce taxes by $2 billion. I turned out to be wrong. The first year, tax revenues went up by over $2.5 billion. At least the direction of my sign was correct. Now, we have made a lot of progress. And I just want to add, those of you know, one of those, Bob Mundell won a Nobel Prize this past week. And for those of us who are supply-siders and our whole sort of libertarian group, Bob was instrumental in our original group in making the tax arguments. People forget, when Ronald Reagan took office, the maximum marginal tax rate was 70%. And as late as 1978, as mentioned, we had a 49% capital gains tax rate. And I mean, the left will never admit it, but we are winning over time. It's been the battle goes on. You never really win. You just got to keep up the battle. But the tide clearly is going in our direction. And part of it is because of the things Peter mentioned of the international competitive. And most of you, or many of you, are not old enough to remember what the rhetoric was like 30 years ago. Burke remembers. But he remembers both before it got bad, after it got bad, and how it got better.
In the cause of fair play, I'm going to ask my other question to Peter. A lot of financial strategists right now are recommending risk minimization approaches. You know, diverse investments, stocks, bonds, cash, coal, for inflation, deflation, recession, whatever. You know, does your vision of a monetary future affect this sort of strategy? If so, how? If not, why not?
Well, I think that if you believe that money, that there's going to be an end of money at some point in the future, and again, it may be a very long time horizon, it may not affect your investing on a shorter time horizon, but it is likely that the kinds of sectors of the economy that will do best are equity-based investments, and government bonds are likely to do very poorly. You know, in the developed world, U.S., Western Europe, Japan, one of the really big problems governments face is a massive demographic crisis, in the sense that there are all these unfunded pension plans. It's worse in Japan. The effect of debt is something like over 250% of GDP in Japan, if you include the government debt plus all the government-affiliated agencies plus the unfunded pensions. Europe's on the order of 150%. U.S. is actually not quite that bad. But this debt is going to be paid off through future taxes. That's how they're going to be basically paying off these pension funds. If you believe that your ability to tax is going to go down because of digital money, there's going to be an enormous problem in paying this off. The way they will probably take care of it is either there will be defaults on bonds, or there will be, or you will have inflation. Those are basically the two ways the government can take care of it: if there is no ability to tax, and if the obligations are too large. And under that sort of scenario, it would be much better to have assets and things that are real. It doesn't necessarily have to be the latest hype real thing like the internet economy, but it could be real equities, real estate. Those kinds of things make a lot more sense. There's probably a way to put together a portfolio that is deflation and inflation adjusted under a lot of different scenarios, combining a variety of assets. I think the important thing is to have value where value really resides, rather than fictional money. One other point I wanted to just sort of make as reminded by Lipschitz's comment on sort of the ways in which tax policies have changed in response to both more enlightened enlightenment and the market pressures. It seems to me that the most remarkable statistic in this regard that I always cite is that between 1986 and today, and it's a mixed story in the sense that in 1986 the marginal income rates in the U.S. were 28%. Today they're 39.6%. The marginal rates on capital were 28%. Today they are 20%. Today we have the widest differential between taxes on capital and income in the history of the United States. Part of the reason for this, I would suggest to you, is that capital is the thing that can move most easily in a global economy. Labor can't move that easily. It's hard to move from country to country. It's much easier to move assets and investments from country to country. And so we have already seen, de facto, an enormous shift of taxation onto capital, onto labor and away from capital as a result of these global monetary pressures. And it's again, if you think back 7 years when Clinton came into office, this would have been the very last thing they would have imagined that they would be doing, would be presiding over this massive shift in the tax burden away from corporations and investors and onto people who are blue-collar workers. So that's effectively what they've done.
Thank you.
One other question that might be related to what Peter was just saying is the issue of whether these kinds of pressures are going to force governments around the world to liquidate their own assets because of these crunches they're going to be facing. Yeah? How about the gentleman in the blue egg?
I think both of you mentioned two of the major factors in shaping the world economy in the future, one being the internet and the other being digital money. But I think that you've ignored a major other factor, and that is the, let's say, as Mao said, that all law is dispensed from the end of a gun. And I think that Peter mentioned the fact that many world governments are looking to create a prison sort of mentality so that no one can escape from the taxation burden that's being imposed by, you know, providing no escape routes as far as economics. And I think the thing that I think that you both ignored is that societies are not only shaped by those sorts of forces and religion and things of that nature, but they're also shaped by the economic return of violence. And that is the amount of return that one gets, depending upon the instruments one uses, forms somewhat of a feedback to social organizations. When economics dictate that a person for a relatively small amount of money can have a weapon in their possession that provides an effective deterrent against the state, then states tend to be small because the economic return is not good. Whereas when economic returns are very good for larger and larger weapon systems like cannons and, of course, nuclear weapons, then everyone wants to possess those because those have the most influence or best political return. And I think that we may be moving into, people have talked about this, a situation where the cost of weapons of mass destruction will drop dramatically, and that will act as a counterbalance to the globalization effort towards creating larger societies because people will have it within their possession. Crazies, no doubt, but people would have it within their power to counterbalance the forces that countries have created through large weapon systems.
So do you want them to comment on that? Is that your question?
Well, I'm just wondering if you agree with that, or is that something that...
I suppose if you want to frame this question sort of a very stark Ayn Rand type terms, there are basically two ways people can make a living. They can earn money or they can steal it. And sort of one of the questions would be, what's more attractive in a given context? Is it easier to steal money? Is it easier to earn money? And you know, I agree with the point that to the extent that the marginal returns on violence are reduced, you have a less violent world. I'm not sure that it comes about by having proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and everyone being able to have a nuclear bomb in their backyard. I think the way it might come about, though, is through the kind of encryption technology Richard and I described, where basically the cost of the government of breaking in becomes more and more expensive. And basically, one way of thinking about it is that under the current system of monetary sovereignty, you have a printing press, you have one printing press in each country, and you need a certain amount of force, political power, whatever you want to call it, to control that one printing press. If basically that process becomes decentralized, where every single person gets to choose what currency they have, you have to control not just the single printing press, but the entire telecommunications grid. And that's a much more difficult thing to do. So the cost, even for the same return on violence, the investment is much greater. And so I think that could tilt things quite a bit. So I definitely agree with your point fundamentally.
It's interesting to note that countries are going for choice of currency. El Salvador is the first country I know who has now just moved to saying you can use any currency you want in El Salvador. And there's a big debate now whether Argentina is fully dollarized because they have a currency board and the dollar is a one-to-one ratio with the Argentine peso. But the peso-denominated bonds sell at an increasing discount to dollar-denominated bonds. And the debate is whether the loss in scenery would be greater or less than getting rid of that discount, and I think most people look at it, say, dollarization would be far better because getting rid of the discount would be far less costly to society than not seeing it.
Gentlemen.
There are many sources of money, like you mentioned.
mentioned McDonald's dollar, and think about the Fortune 500, all of them issuing dollars, or maybe even 10% of them issuing dollars. What would be the that brings up a we call it an exchange ratio problem, which a computer can handle. But what would be the matter with using gold as the standard?
Well, there's nothing wrong with using gold. In fact, there's a company out of Melbourne, Florida, that has a product called e-gold, digital gold. And what you do is you buy gold that's basically bullion, 100% reserve, and they give you digital gold, which you can use for various purchases and move stuff around. There's a lot of experiments like this taking place. I mean, when you think about the companies doing it, for years people took American Express travelers, which were a form of a private currency. And people knew American Express well enough and had faith that they could redeem the car. As long as people believed that McDonald's and General Motors and whoever else will be pretty much interchangeable. It comes from a company you've never heard of, you'll probably either be accepted or maybe acquire a discount on it. Then you also get into the question of what kind of reserve if your gold state came up. And it'll be interesting to see how the market sorts this out on what the reserve policy would be. In my book, I point out that I think we'll go to mutual fund banking, which is very close to the kind of model that Peter described, where you have real wealth, you know, real incentive corporate stock represents real earning asset. That becomes monetary base.
Yeah, this is kind of going back to the gentleman's comment about the social fabric. When you've got a certain percentage of the world that's educated, and then will certainly drive to this type of technology, when the masses of the people certainly will be somewhat left behind. Just sort of comment on what you see and how the governments are going to hold the social fabric together for all of those people that realistically are going to be left behind out of this wave of technology as we go into the future.
I don't believe people are going to be left behind. People are far better off. If you take a look at what's happened, when we talk about the Clinton years, we've had talk about the disparity in income growth. But at the same time, the bottom has been rising sharply. And I think in the U.S. we have a lot less social tension now than we've had in a good long while, you know, probably since near the end of World War II, because the bottom has been rising. The opportunity, when you have a full employment economy, which has been brought about by technology, not government. I know I live in Fairfax County, Virginia, and the official unemployment rate is 1.2%, which means if you can stand up and breathe, you've got a job. And this is spreading in the places where they've got the problems, where you have the government interferences with labor markets, like in Europe. So I think governments are going to take a look at the successful models, because this is getting out now. The word is getting out what works. And, you know, the Hong Kong, U.S., New Zealand, Switzerland type model clearly is far superior to the socialist model. And I think increasingly you may have the left-wing rhetoric, but you see even in Europe with a lot of left-wing rhetoric, but a lot of their policies are moving grudgingly in the right direction.
I think that things are going to get better across the board. I think that if we talk about sort of income distribution and how that's going to change in the 21st century, sort of what I take to be one of the questions about this. My view is that fundamentally what's going to happen is income distribution will get much wider within countries and much smaller between countries. So that, you know, the real injustice today is not that some people in the U.S. are being paid 10 times as much as other people in the U.S. It is that, say, a software developer in India is being paid 5% as much as the exact same person in the U.S. That strikes me as sort of the far greater injustice of the two. And I think that sort of injustice is going to really start to disappear in the 21st century. And
And basically, the people globally who are at the bottom of the heap are poor people in emerging market countries. And that is the group of people, I think, that will, as a whole, benefit the most because they've suffered the most from despotic governments.
Another aspect of that is that even in the U.S., where the question is whether there'll be some sort of a wide access to these kinds of technologies and products and so forth, I think the answer is that the cost is being so radically reduced to have access to these kinds of choices, it means that people will not, as Peter is saying, have to be subject to a monopoly system. They actually will have the opportunity to choose the kind of systems they want to participate in.
Just one quick point, just a very simple thing. The cost of a message over the internet is a fraction of the cost of a stamp. And that benefits everybody. And now, you know, they're almost getting 2 feet away and soon they'll be close to that. And so really communication costs can be for everybody. And it helps the people at the bottom much more so than people could always do.
Let's see. About the gentleman in the blue right there.
Thank you. The potential benefits of the globalization with exchange are pretty clear to me, but I guess I'm curious, do you guys think it's all positive, or do you foresee any potential difficulties of liberalization of the monetary exchange may create for, say, entrepreneurs and private companies seeking to gain access or expand penetration in global markets and developing markets? I mean, for the entrepreneur in a developing country, may they be shut out or, you know, thwarted by such a liberalization of exchange?
As you have the globalization of the financial markets, entrepreneurs now have access almost to global capital. I mean, there's all these services going up the internet. And so you can, you can bid for mortgages now. And as we have knowing what the price is globally, people often paid way too much for capital or goods in the past, because there were locational monopolies, because they didn't have information. And now if you're a Japanese housewife and you become quickly aware that in the U.S. you pay one-third the cost for rice, they're going to put pressures on their own governments or any product. And I see this happening in a place like Finland, which I know a bit about. There they had very high tariffs on automobiles. And I noticed they're just going to, because they're so wired in, that's wireless in their case, that they're going to direct auto sales to manufacturers. And it's going to make a huge pressure to reduce those tariffs on those auto prices, because everybody will know the best price in the world. And if you're in a particular country and you say, why in the world am I have to pay 4 or 5 times as much as somebody else in a different country? That's a huge pressure on their governments to change policies.
I'm sorry, can I just respond? Might that drown out the small-town guy and just, you know, kind of let the MNCs roll in and take all the business, or?
Let's see. I suppose the question is, in a depoliticized, in a world where there's less political power in national governments, the question is really who benefits. Is it large corporate entities or is it small entrepreneurs? Let's frame the question that way. My view is that it's fundamentally the small entrepreneur, because in our current regime, if you're a multinational corporation, you can afford to buy lobbyists, you can get all sorts of benefits from the government. You know, when the U.S. Chamber of Commerce sends a trade delegation to China, they have, planes full of executives from the Fortune 500 companies. They don't have a bunch of people doing internet startups in Silicon Valley, but they fly all over the world. And so the current way in which politics distorts the market tends to be benefiting large corporations and disadvantaging smaller companies. And I think that basically the trend that we have seen over the last 20 years is that the countries that have liberalized economies, the ratio of people working for big companies to small companies has actually gone way down. The best illustration of this is comparing U.S. to Western Europe. Since the early 1970s, Fortune 500 companies in the U.S. have created no net new jobs. There are fewer people working for Fortune 500 companies today than there were 30 years ago. And in Western Europe, and all the jobs are created in small entrepreneurial type contexts. In Western Europe, which has not deregulated the economy, that's basically not taken place. And the only job growth, the big companies haven't created a lot more jobs. The government is employing more people, and the unemployment rate's gone up. That's basically what's happened in Western Europe. And so I think fundamentally politics tends to benefit powerful corporate entities, and because of that, a diminution of politics, so we tend to help on the better. The cost of rent seeking is rising. Rent seeking, privilege seeking. You say, well, some of the Fortune 500 executives have been complaining about the arms both political parties put on them, because they're getting less and less for those dollars.
There's a school of economics called public choice, which studies the kind of questions that you're asking, and basically what they show is that politics is used as a way to concentrate benefits and diffuse costs, and the result is that regulations almost inevitably are used or captured, either advocated and or captured by interest groups that can use it to advance their goals through essentially non-market means, and that's where concentration actually is created. We have time for one more question, I think. let's see. I think we'll have to ask the gentleman to say, sorry. See, I guess I better make this good.
For those of us who are waiting the 21st century with 401ks and many of us making more money than we absolutely need to live on, in other words, with money to do things with, and ability to search the internet and so forth, where should we be looking? I took a little tour on the internet today in anticipation of this talk, and on those subjects that we covered tonight, there are, you know, dozens and dozens of websites out there catering to that. Are there any really juicy ones that have the most reliable information or the best loads to mine for individuals?
That would be www.independent.org.
Any comments?
No particular thoughts on that. I'm not going
to...
It's been very interesting because I'm seeing all these happening. Stuff that we're doing, and I think mentioned ego, relevant leadership, and I keep running into these companies all the time. And it's just the very beginning stages of this revolution. And it's not obvious yet who's going to be the future Microsoft of this area. It will be Microsoft.
I want to thank our speakers for their work and for their wonderful presentations. And thank you for joining with us. Again, there are copies of The End of Money upstairs. And Richard would be delighted to autograph copies if you haven't done so already. And again, The Independent Review is brand new. So we hope that you'll join with us next time. Thank you for coming. Good night.